Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. Today, we will be discussing the recent innovations and legal challenges to artificial intelligence. My name is Elizabeth Dickinson, and I am an assistant director with the Regulatory Transparency Project. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. In order to get right to the discussion, I'll hand things off to our moderator, who will introduce our experts and the conversation. Kevin Frazier is an adjunct professor at Delaware Law, AI fellow at the Lawfare Institute, and emerging technology scholar at St. Thomas University College of Law, where he previously served as an assistant professor. And with that, I'll hand things off to you, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth, and thank you to Steve Schaefer and the entire Regulatory Transparency Project for the chance to host this important conversation. It's my great honor to dive into AI on Valentine's Day, of all days. Don't tell my wife, but my first love was and is thinking about how the law can accelerate innovation rather than inhibit it. So it only feels right to be talking about AI on this special lovely day. It's my pleasure to be joined by Megan Ma, Associate Director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology, and the Stanford Center for Legal Informatics, and Dhruva Krishna, Visiting Jurist at UCLA School of Law and a Corporate Attorney in LA. First, let's set the stage. It's not a question of whether the federal government will use AI, but how and to what extent those uses run up to legal barriers. As of late 2024, a survey of 37 federal agencies tallied more than 1,700 different use cases of AI. Moving into the Trump administration, it's clear that AI promises to feature even more prominently in efforts to streamline and improve government services. DOGE recently made headlines for using AI to look into wasteful spending in the Department of Education. And this is likely just the start of looking to AI to achieve the administration's goals. President Trump's executive order on AI called for achieving AI dominance, so we can expect that this is just the beginning of much more AI use to come. And that dominance will start at home with respect to the federal government. AI's integration into the government, though, faces several barriers. There's popular skepticism on one hand, and on the other, substantial legal hurdles. Let's start with popular skepticism. Megan, I'll come to you first. Why do you think folks have doubts about government use of AI? And to what extent do you think those fears are meritorious or perhaps grounded in a misunderstanding of the technology?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again, Kevin. And thanks to the Regulatory Transparency Project. I feel really happy to be here. I think one thing that has been quite fascinating about sort of this rise of generative AI or the onset of using this technology in all different facets is that, well, historically, a lot of this technology was on the back end. And so we've seen a lot of like older versions with machine learning and deep learning. But because it wasn't front and center, people were less worried about it. And so, I mean, integrations into, say, Grammarly and any of the other tools that we're familiar with, it seemed to be fine. But this kind of widespread sudden mistrust kind of came up with headliner news about, you know, in the legal space, everyone's heard of Mata versus Avianca and hallucination became a very big thing. But I think it speaks to actually a deeper problem, which is we have a serious double standard between human output versus machine output. And I think it's because historically in kind of these white collar professions or, you know, these tertiary services, we've never really had to be confronted with the question of, you know, what is quality in our practice? And, you know, speaking from the legal profession itself, I don't think that any of us really have a consensus on what qualifies as a good contract. A lot of partners will say, I know it when I see it, but, and this is some sort of gut reaction, but if it boils down to a number of metrics or kind of different ways of classifying, you know, what's good and bad, we really have no standard behind it or no kind of joint, you know, effort to work towards a standard necessarily. And so because of this, I think this mistrust continues to sort of boil. And I think there's also a lot of obvious hesitation around bias and fairness and applications of this technology kind of in more reckless fashions, just because, you know, there is an ignorance around some parts of the technology. And of course, like, as well, in this current generation of generative AI, explainability is still quite a complicated concept. Anthropic and other researchers have started to dig into this, but still there isn't kind of enough scholarship. And so I think it's an amalgamation, again, of all of these things, where if we don't have, you know, core metrics around the quality and the quality of human output, then we have difficulty with benchmarking, you know, how the machines actually perform against humans. And then on the other hand, of course, there's, you know, this continuous sort of fear around how do you tackle bias, and bias being that particularly for generative AI, in some of the kind of current use cases, we'll see that they can't be generalized. And I think that that's also something that is worrisome. Kind of what's interesting, if I may, there's one more anecdote that I kind of always frequently discuss, and something that, you know, I've shared with you, Kevin, before, which is the story of Devin. And I always think that that is such a great example of this double standard that exists. This story that goes, or this anecdote that goes, which was featured in X or Twitter, was that this manager had deployed Devin, which is an autonomous software engineer that was created by Cognition Labs. What was interesting about it is that the manager at first onboarded Devin, not telling the rest of his team that Devin is an autonomous software engineer. And then everyone kind of obviously gives grace to the new guy, so to speak. And they were filling in tasks, doing a bunch of work, and they were asking questions on different websites to kind of look out for their own answers. And then kind of later that day, the software manager revealed that, hey, this is an autonomous software engineer. How did it do? And immediately the kind of sentiment turned. It was as if, you know, everyone became suddenly immensely critical. Well, it didn't do this. It didn't know how to do this in the code. There were all these mistakes. And it's just really revealing, I think, in general, that we can always afford kind of this grace and almost seeing like new onboarding as an opportunity to, you know, there's still a learning experience, but there's absolutely no learning curve when it comes to these machines. It has to be perfection or nothing.
Yeah. And what I think is really telling about that story is we've all seen maybe one of the most famous charts about sentencing lengths with judges before and after they've had a snack. And you want to get the judge after lunch, right? Because they're hungry, or excuse me, you want to get the judge after lunch because they're full, they're happy, and they're not going to sentence you to as long of a period. But don't find that hungry judge. And the great thing is AI doesn't get hungry. And we need to recognize that in many instances, you actually may be better off having AI make an adjudication about your Social Security benefits or whether or not you qualify for a certain program. So, Dhruva, now turning to you, why do you think there's still this hesitation around adoption of AI into government?
Yeah, definitely. And first, of course, thank you, the Federal Society, RTP, Kevin, Megan, for being on the call. I would just say that I think one thing we have to really remember with AI is that the public has been primed by our society to expect this technology for decades, right? We've all seen Terminator 2. We've all read the sci-fi, right? This is very different than something like blockchain, which is decentralized finance and nodes and all these things. All of us have a vision of AI that's been given to us through decades and decades of Hollywood, various sci-fi novels, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of people who, when they hear artificial intelligence, Skynet comes to mind immediately, right? Something Skynet-like. That is a very hard bias to overcome very quickly. And I think we as a society are, because we're not getting Skynet, we're getting LLMs, right? And I think that's something that we have to always keep in mind, is that unlike many other new technologies that begin purely theoretical, many folks already have an idea of what this technology does, which is honestly largely flawed. Putting that aside, I think the other reason why there's a lot of doubts is because AI is very much in its like TMZ time period, right? It is currently this very, very dynamic, personality-filled news headline that Megan was talking about. It almost reminds me of that video of Bill Gates when he was dancing at the Microsoft launch, but that times 100, right? Just 2 or 3 days ago, we have Sam Altman taking shots at Elon in an interview in a very, very like Gen Z millennial way, right? So I think as someone who's also younger, I understand the hesitancy when people are talking about implementing technologies that are so recent that we have a bias towards, that are being made by these kind of mavericks and using them in probably our most important government functions. That makes a lot of sense to me as why we have those concerns. What I would say is I think a lot of those concerns can be mitigated, and we'll get into that, I'm sure. And I think that a lot of people do have a misunderstanding of how AI actually fits into this larger project we call democracy, or we call America, or whatever we want to call it, right? As a corporate attorney, my other background I want to bring in is that AI is obviously a very profitable business. I think that sometimes people have a skepticism about that, right? When NVIDIA has a $3.4 trillion market cap and is worth more than most countries, I think a lot of people get up in arms about whether we can trust for-profit entities with things that are tied to things like democracy, voting, et cetera. I understand that. And I think we can also get into that as well. But for me, from the average person, when I talk to my friends or my partner or my parents, and I say, so why are you skeptical about using ChatGPT in the government in some way or to, you know, efficient, make the DMV more efficient? It really stems down to a bias that was created through lots of media, a deep misunderstanding of what the technology actually does, this kind of newer age skepticism of wealth generally. And I think a fundamental thing is they are not ingrained in the technology on a day-to-day basis. So they are very confused on how it works. And thus that instills a lot of fear.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Sometimes when I talk to people about generative AI, I'll say, so tell me which model you're using. Are you using Claude, ChatGPT, Gemini? And they'll say, Gemini? No, I'm a Virgo. I don't know what you're talking about. It's way off, right? I'm like, no. We need to zoom out a little bit. But to your point, Dhruva, I think so much of this is grounded in fear of the unknown. Yes. And it takes something that's difficult within us as humans to say, okay, rather than be skeptical, I'm going to experiment. But I think it's worth pointing out, cavemen wouldn't have gotten very far if upon creating fire, their first question was, how do we extinguish it, right? We need to think about how quickly we can put it out, right? The question was, wow, I can't wait to cook things with this. This will be delicious. And those who experimented with it are our forebears, not the ones who were rapidly trying to put it out. So I do want to highlight some important efforts underway, particularly in Oklahoma, with respect to AI literacy. Because as we've talked about, so much of these concerns, the benefits we can realize from AI won't be achieved if the public is just reading the TMZ equivalent of AI fear-mongering. Mm-hmm. And programs like in Oklahoma, where they're partnering with Google to create an AI Essentials program for 10,000 residents, that's something everyone should be copying. And so I'm very optimistic that we'll see, hopefully, AI literacy expand. But assuming we eventually address some of these public barriers and confront that skepticism head on, it's also worth pointing out that there are legal barriers in the way of rapid AI adoption. Believe it or not, most of our federal laws were not created with ChatGPT in mind. And when we're thinking about issue spotting as good lawyers, I want to encourage us to think both of the crazier side of legal issues that might arise, as well as kind of the more mundane issues that we may need to pay attention to. So, Megan, I'd love to start with you on just what some potential hurdles may be, even if they seem potentially outlandish to folks who aren't as steeped in this world.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've been hearing kind of recurring is this fear around accountability, like who is going to be, you know, responsible if something goes wrong, especially with an AI agent. And so you imagine the sort of state of the art that's come out from OpenAI recently was deep research. And so it's right now capable of producing research papers at actually a B grade, which to me, for my students, you know, it's not actually that bad. And so if I'm imagining them as, you know, a kind of policy analyst or a policy intern that's going to be working with me. So actually, just to backtrack, for those, you know, that are not familiar with AI agents, but in this kind of current space, it's just this idea that it's software that's able to kind of interpret a goal and then identify its own ways of achieving that particular goal. In the case of deep research, it's sort of like this standalone kind of software capable of going out and you pose a research question and it's able to kind of produce a really comprehensive report. And so now kind of this era of, you know, these tools that are just interpreting much more abstract goals as opposed to just, you know, individual tasks, you're sort of in this space where, well, you know, who is actually kind of guarding these AI agents and the work products that they produce? And there's been a lot of kind of scholarship and discussion about, you know, are people actually increasing or decreasing their capabilities of being critical? And I think that's why it kind of lends itself to this like accountability question where, you know, if people are sort of reducing their critical analytical abilities and kind of increasing their trust towards these tools because, you know, the initial fairy dust around how good these tools is still there, then what are we going to do, you know, if, you know, something goes wrong? And, you know, I'm always reminded of in the past where, you know, there's a tool back in 2017 that was really, really popular in the medical space. It was created by a company called Babylon Health, and it was a consumer-facing tool that was capable of diagnosing diseases, and especially rare diseases. And I thought that it was quite interesting because they bragged to no end at the time that they were capable of achieving 92% accuracy on diagnosis, in comparison to medical doctors trained at Harvard, trained at Oxford, or whatever tier one university with 30 years of experience. And they said something about, you know, like the 85% accuracy. I don't actually know how they make these types of calculations. You know, that's one thing. But the recurring question was, well, what happens with misdiagnosis of these tools? With, you know, a doctor, it is actually pretty common to hear about a 1 in 8 misdiagnosis and where you get a second opinion. But where do you get the second opinions of these AI agents? And so that's why a lot of people have been floating, you know, the concept of legal personhood. But I think, you know, in our current state, I still think it's a little bit far-fetched because there are other types of safeguards, guardrails that you can put in place. But that, I think, is one perspective that people have been thinking about, is this purely accountability question.
Yeah, and it's so important to point out, too, because the stakes for government use of AI agents can be quite high, right? If you're having an AI agent or any automated system make a determination about your Social Security benefits, for instance, you may be quite angry if you get a letter back, hey, your benefits have been denied, the AI told me so. Well, that's not very satisfactory, right? And that doesn't have a whole lot of support in notions, traditional notions of due process. And so I think this is one area where we're really going to have to see a sort of reimagination of what due process looks like on mass adjudication by AI. That's a sticky wicket to figure out, but it's certainly not one that current law necessarily addresses. So we've got these issues around AI agents, obviously imposing some very big questions about accountability. Dhruva, throw some other law at us. We're issue spotting, right? Get all those points. What else are we looking for?
So I think Megan's point ties nicely into mine, which is I think we are still, once again, this wild west of approach, right? So off accountability, right? There's a great book. I think it was called the like 100 words that made the internet, which is about Section 230, right? And how we really benefited from this early piece of legislation that allowed the internet to foster, right? In terms of accountability and those questions, we don't actually have that certainty yet. There's a lot of uncertainty, right? We're trying to force the AI square peg into the triangle hole in a lot of ways, right? How does AI fit into tort law? How does AI fit into maritime law? How does AI, you know, the law of the horse, right? All these kind of different things are going on. I think that uncertainty, just breaking that out further, even plays into approach of AI models, right? We are still living in the not so open AI versus open source debate, right? Until DeepSeek really kind of, you know, as Mark Andreessen said, it was this huge moment. That is still a viable question that the models themselves are discussing, right? I think Sam Altman on a Reddit AMA, which is crazy to think about, like three weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, said, we were actually wrong. Open source probably is right. Moving on, which is a huge statement to be made. So I think what a lot of lawyers and I think a lot of legal minded folks forget is that the industry itself is still tackling these very fundamental questions of how do we get to where we want to go? And as a result, the law cannot keep up, right? And what I want to contrast that with is what's going on in the crypto industry right now, right? So for example, in crypto over the last decade, we had this very strong over-enforcement priority strategy, depending who you ask, like an intentional anti-crypto mafia basically going on at the SEC. But honestly, if you talk to a lot of real industry players at most of these large companies, a lot of them agree that we do actually need good rules, right? The regulation is what they want, right? There aren't as many people saying we want no rules, Wild West it. What they're saying is we want clear pathways to registration, securities registration, etc. I'm not necessarily sure if AI is at that place yet. Where, like, I think in some ways we are. I think most people do think there should be some ethical guidelines, or we shouldn't just allow for Skynet to actually be made. Like, fair enough. But we're still having these very, very, very tricky questions based around AI uncertainty. I mean, even the questions about fair use and copyright, we're getting the Copyright Office basically punting so many times, giving us all these different guidance points, et cetera. And we're just really figuring it out. So off the original question, what is one of the big hurdles? The big hurdles is that this is a very fast moving target. And it's a very uncertain target, right? And we're basically trying to hit a bullet train with a bow and arrow, right? It's very, very, very difficult. My suggestion is, and you know, what my research has kind of been getting at is, it's useful to understand that first, and then see what legislation or rules we need to address, like specific harms, for example, right? So, for example, I think most people agree there should be some level of anti-pornographic deepfake act addressing type things. There's that. And then there's the laws that are saying, if you ever manipulate media, you will go to prison for like 20 years, right? And I think that's kind of the balance we're striking, which is because we don't know how to really, we don't actually have a firm understanding of the underlying technology itself.
And to add on to that point, besides first specifying, it sounds like you just need to work on your archery skills, right? If you want to hit that.
Yeah, exactly.
Get out there, start working on that. But yeah. But relatedly, it seems like a huge issue here that we haven't necessarily discussed. We talked earlier about AI literacy being a problem for the general public. There's also an AI literacy component for the federal government, right?
100%.
Unfortunately, when we think federal employee, we usually don't think, yes, AI PhD, Stanford trained. They're up and up on AI. They know all the machine learning. They can describe a neural network. No, right? If we go agency by agency, there's not a ton of training that's been done on AI literacy to combat things like automation bias, where we see folks just default to whatever the AI algorithm told them to do. So huge learning curve there. I also just want to flag my particular issue spotting area here would be laws like the Privacy Act. So the Privacy Act passed in 1974 in response to Watergate. Everyone's really wanting to make sure there's more transparency and accountability in the federal government. So in case folks haven't read the text of the Privacy Act in a second, it prohibits an agency from disclosing any record which is contained in a system of records by any means of communication to any person or another agency. And just to stress a couple things here, record is broadly defined. So any piece of personal, personally identifiable information, or PII, qualifies as a record. And courts have interpreted disclosure very broadly. So one issue right now in the DOGE context, coming into the Department of Education and saying, hey, let's look through all these grants and try to identify where there may be waste. Good motive? Heck yes. I think everyone would say, if we can identify fraud, if we can identify waste, let's do it. So A plus on that front. F minus, does that comply with the Privacy Act? Now, under current interpretation, probably not, right? If you're disclosing PII that may be in those grants to a third party AI system, it's not a slam dunk case if you're DOGE right now to try to defend that practice. So updating some of these laws that have really good intentions, but just weren't motivated for or animated by the reality of using AI toward better service, streamlined government service, is a big task for the federal government. Now, thinking about that, I had an interesting LinkedIn conversation, which is something you only say if you're not young anymore. I'm on LinkedIn and I'm saying, you know, federal government needs to lean into AI. This is a good thing. Don't be scared. And somebody responds, why? Just why? Why should we even use AI in the federal government? Why don't we just pretend that this revolution isn't happening? They didn't say that part. They just left why, dropped the mic, and then logged off, I'm assuming. So, Megan, why should we be encouraging this use of AI? Why can't the federal government just say, hey, we're going to take a timeout, we'll let OpenAI figure it out, and then tell us how to use this? Why should we encourage this sort of experimentation and adoption?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a great question. First, I think this is one of those technologies, as you were saying, like literacy really matters here. I think an important part is that a lot of this fear comes from an ignorance around the technology. And in the past, as I mentioned, you know, all this technology was hidden. It was on the back end, but this is now front and center. And of course, like, as I mentioned with AI agents, kind of, you know, a lot of tech companies in the Silicon Valley, they're kind of declaring it as the year of AI. And so we're kind of faced with a reality that we're entering into the era of human-machine collaboration, whether we like it or not. And I think one thing that's been fascinating, sort of historically, what we've seen is there was a push from sort of blue collar into white collar. And I think we're at kind of an inflection point where what's post white collar almost, or what's kind of an entrance past the tertiary services. I think the other thing is, as we mentioned, is we often have these really kind of broad sweeping descriptions of jobs or even tasks, but we don't realize that there's a lot of these subtasks that these machines are actually far better than we are at doing them. And, you know, one thing for sure is information retrieval. That needle in the haystack, you know, task is actually really, really well done in troves and troves of volumes. And so I think, for example, when it comes to thinking about how we should be treating this technology, I think if we don't use it, it'd be a serious miss. And I think not only would it be a miss, that those who are actually thinking about integrating and in the private sector, this is happening now and more than ever. And so just as a kind of single example, this is one that is often brought up. Some people were thinking about, in the kind of patents, in the space of patent law, a lot of people wanted to file patents and, you know, they think that this technology is really good at drafting sort of these standard patent filings. If you can imagine sort of the USPTO facing all of a sudden with an avalanche of patent filings, and they are not kind of integrating any of this technology on their end, you're really only increasing that backlog that already exists. And so I think this kind of like small use case can be applied more broadly, that because it's already happening in other sectors, it's only fair that the government should be thinking about ways of integrating.
Yeah, it's wild to think of if the federal government had seen what happened at Kitty Hawk, been like, cool, flight was discovered. We're good with cars. We like horses. We're just going to stay on the ground. You all go run with that. We're just going to stick on the land. It seems a little safer here, and we'll just miss this revolution. So, Dhruva, what are some rationales for why you are kind of pro-adoption in this case?
So I'm definitely a techno-optimist, and I'm one of those guys that is like, AI is our version of fire, right? Like, it is species changing in the long term. So for me, it's a bit of a hard question to answer because it's one that I just assume, right? But when I was thinking about this question, I think there's a few different points. One, I think there's an inevitability question, which is, it is inevitable that this technology is already so integrated everywhere. And I'm not even speaking about high level use cases. I just mean on social media. Like, even on things like LinkedIn, there are AI bots everywhere. There are people making AI content. There's like one or two influencers who are like, I haven't made a real piece of content in months. This is actually like an AI agent making all this stuff for me. So I think in terms of things like democracy and how on a very ground level people interact with each other and have opinions and form them, we as a society have already signed off on AI being a big part of that. And the government has some type of role, duty, et cetera, to understand that. So in short, just given how often it's being used already, I think it's very clear the government should also understand this technology is changing its populace's like identity in many ways, right? That's one. I think that the second thing is, I do actually believe that it has a lot of benefits for, you know, depending on the US, making democracy more accessible. And on the other side, you know, drain the swamp, right? That whole side of things. The whole DOGE mission of, you know, we can use technology to make things less bureaucratic, right? I think I'm not sure how signed off I am on various methods of doing that. And that's kind of the hard part. Like Kevin, like you said, the Privacy Act, right? We all agree that the government should be efficient. Not all of us agree that we should have people like sifting through our loan data. Fair enough. But I do think there is something there that I think a lot of younger folks especially understand. The DMV can work a lot better if we maybe use some blockchain and AI to keep the records clear, right? Fair enough. So that's another thing. I think the third thing, which is I think where President Trump and his administration is really coming into play, is like the national security aspect and this idea of like American tech dominance as not just like techno-nationalism, but a really important part of a global American agenda. I mean, you know, the little tech agenda, you know, A16, all those guys, they're all bought in. I think you're even seeing that the whole DeepSeek controversy, right? We're seeing DeepSeek that's being this model that was, one, there's this whole question about IP theft, whatever, but it's obviously almost like an AI arms race. How could this hedge fund manager guy using like a tenth of the resources suddenly make a model that we're putting like millions and billions of dollars into, right? And it's becoming a bit similar to like Oppenheimer style discussions over how can we get faster, stronger, better, et cetera, with the least amount of resources. Once again, I think I'm bought into that insofar as I do think just given how important AI is, the national security threats are actually real and the government, which honestly has done a great job is getting ahead of that and saying the quiet part out loud, which is we want to be the dominant force here. And that is actually very important, like just a mere safety point of view. Like, let's put aside all the economics of safety. So I am bought into all of those parts. I think each of those kind of plays a large part, but yeah, I do agree with you, Kevin, that obviously the government should be adopting AI, be knowledgeable about AI, fostering it, et cetera.
I just think it's so important, and you both of you were pointing this out, to consider the counterfactual. And I don't want to live in the counterfactual where all of our adversaries are leaning into AI to develop the most sophisticated cyber attacks, for example. And we said, no, we're going to slow walk AI and not develop the responsive defensive measures. I also don't want to live in the counterfactual where, for example, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers isn't using AI to accurately predict flooding, right? I would much rather, and I'm guessing millions of Americans who are affected by by hurricanes this year or polar vortexes right now, would love if NOAA, for example, could give them a week's notice or 2 weeks' notice of potential disasters, rather than just waiting for their local weather person to say, oh, right, watch out, folks, you might want to move. Similarly, I am very much a fan of the Social Security Administration using AI to proactively identify individuals who may be eligible for benefits, right? Rather than just forcing folks through endless bureaucratic loopholes. If you qualify for benefits, let's give them to you, right? Like, let's support Americans. So that's my push, is when folks can test the use of AI, I think it's so valuable to say, hey, look at this very specific example, and there's 1,700 of them that we can pull from, to say, tell me if you want to live in that counterfactual. And if that's the case, I don't know, maybe move to like Nova Scotia. I'm not sure if AI is having a huge
impact.
Go to Greenland. But, you know, if you want to be free from AI and don't want those benefits, don't stay here. I don't know. Find a different, go be a Luddite somewhere else. But, okay. With all that said, I want to end our cheery Valentine's Day conversation on an aspirational note, or perhaps a fearful one that we can discuss later. So, Megan, what's something that's exciting you or scaring you at this moment that you'd like to leave listeners with?
So I want to end on an optimistic note. And I will say that I think something you mentioned in the opening is DOGE trying to find ways of cutting sort of wasteful spending, quote unquote, in the ministry or Department of Education. To me, actually, education is the biggest focal point that we need to think about going forward. You sort of bring home really well. And as well, like Dhruva, you also mentioned this, I think literacy is everything here in understanding the technology, or at least making the case of experimenting to get to know better how these tools work. But on the other side of it is, how do we think about the future of educating our coming generations? Kind of my current mission is all about, how do you integrate generative AI into the legal education space? How do you prepare the next generation of lawyers? And I think especially for professional services, this is kind of like the first time where there's a technology that is directly targeting kind of the area of professional services. And so for us, I think rather than thinking about ways of cutting sort of education spending, I think we should be increasing how we're thinking about preparing for different methods of education. I think for the first time, you know, there's going to be scalable, personalized tutoring. That's really, really exciting. And thinking about all these different ways of encasing experiential knowledge, I think that's sort of the future that I want to see. So if I think about kind of the use of AI agents and the promise of tomorrow, it's thinking about how all these agents are going to be really impactful for making sure that our next generation is better, stronger, faster, and more agile than we ever would.
I like this optimism. And I think this is extremely important too, when you think about an American First agenda and AI dominance. It's not enough if we just lead from developing the best frontier models if no Americans know how to use them.
How to use it.
Right? So we are far more resilient, far more likely to endure and thrive in an AI world if we lean into that agenda. So Dhruva, how about you? Hopefully optimism as well. But if you've got to go the negative route, you do you.
I'll give you one of both, just to be fair. So I think what I'm excited about is this idea of, We are in an era of immense growth, right? I think we're in an era now where the government and the industry is bought in. And I completely agree with Megan's comments that we need the literacy part as well. But at the very least, we now have two out of the three people bought in. So I think we're going to start getting really unbelievable results out of that competition and that synergy. I mean, just with DeepSeek itself, right? That's unbelievable. And we're like just at the beginning of base camp before you even go to the summit, right? So I'm wondering in 4 or 5 years what's going to come out of this synergy, these partnerships, etc. I think that's also something that I personally feel as an attorney, because all of us are lawyers with a law school, etc., is making things more efficient and accessible, especially in these white collar corporate arenas. There's been a lot of good work coming out about how AI can be used. And I think, Kevin, you actually talk about this, how AI can be used to make court systems more accessible, right? Just, you know, things like civil claims, et cetera, taking and removing dockets, using them in these different ways to actually analyze caseload, making this allocating resources. I'm very excited about that because that is a very immediate and practical impact. I think the main concern I have as someone who is millennial, who's kind of gone through the social media window platform whole thing, is how AI affects our critical thinking. I think there's a lot of good research coming out that talks about AI is a good, it should make you more efficient, but it should not be a substitute. And my biggest concern, this is part of education, obviously in younger generations, obviously in my generation, is people using these tools to replace critical thinking, right? And we see it with social media already, right? We've gone from 60 minutes to like 60 seconds to 15 seconds in terms of getting news, right? There is a real concern on my end about what happens if that is now affecting things like complex legal systems. If we are using like something like a ChatGPT to analyze very complex First Amendment issues or gun issues or climate change or whatever, it just becomes this thing of we still need to have people who are knowledgeable behind the scenes to fact check. And I sometimes think people in the AI space forget that, right? There's a million and a half memes, photos of people asking ChatGPT funny things and getting the wrong results. It would be terrifying if that was actually used to like sentence someone. Right. And then, of course, on the back half of that is once again all the national security side things of using models from adversarial countries that might censor results, how that changes truth, etc. So I think there's extremely high risk, extremely high reward. As like a VC lawyer, that makes sense to me. But I think that's something that I'm both optimistic and cautious about.
To piggyback on that, I would encourage especially any parents listening to this to check out the character.ai litigation right now about
exactly
kids using AI as companions and doing some really sketchy things with their AI companion that I'm sure most parents would not approve of. That's a scary world that I don't think any of us want to explore. Everyone here has probably seen Her. No one wants that Her. reality to come about where, you know, instead of people trying to marry the Golden Gate Bridge, they're trying to marry their chatbot, you know, scary times. So let's not go there. I'm going to end on three quick notes. First, I'm going to scare the lawyers. Remember that the ABA model rules and most likely your state rules require tech competence. So you can't hide from AI. That is not how you can survive as a lawyer. You have to engage with this technology. Number two, really want to celebrate Cal State University, the Cal State system. They are adopting ChatGPT across their entire system, making it accessible to their students, their faculty, and their staff, and encouraging its use. That's what we should see from, especially from every public university system, if we're trying to train the next generation of Americans who are going to lead us to a greater, more prosperous future. We have to lean into it. And then finally, do want to applaud Case Western University School of Law, the first school to require 1Ls to get an AI certificate.
Wow.
We should see that across all law schools, right? Yeah, I know. You would have thought Harvard, NYU, Stanford, Case Western. So kudos to Case Western. And kudos again to the Regulatory Transparency Project for hosting this conversation. Dhruva, Megan, thanks so much for joining. This was a hoot and a half and really enjoyable.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks,
Dhruva.
What a great conversation. Thank you all so much for listening today. And thank you, of course, to our experts for sharing their insight and opinions. If you're interested in learning more about our programming, discussing the regulatory state and the American way of life, please visit our website at regproject.org. That is regproject.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.